I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our
I'm
children.
Disabilities Beat reporter Emily Watkins, and this is What's Next. When we experience change and the grief that comes with it, there's a tendency to focus on one part of us. Our body changes, perhaps with age, perhaps due to disability, and we focus on the physical. We experience trauma, and we tend to focus on the mind. Adaptive yoga teacher Matthew Sanford is known for his practice connecting the two, reconnecting our body to mind and building resilience. In April, he visited the University at Buffalo to train and teach healthcare workers, yoga teachers, and the community about his yoga practice and how we can build a body-to-mind resilience. Here's my conversation with Sanford before one of his adaptive yoga classes at UB.
Well, Matt, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down and chat with me today.
It's an honor to be here.
To kick things off, tell me a little bit about why you're in Buffalo right now.
I was invited by Susan Dolce, who works at the University of Buffalo and the Disability Services. She's been a longtime student and peer and colleague. And I've come out here a couple different times because she's very active in disability services, but also in the yoga community, the adaptive yoga community here. And she wanted me to come back because she's retiring. She's been a lot of years at the University of Buffalo, and we should all honor what she's done. It's been great. But she wanted me to come back because she was retiring. And then she worked it out that the medical school and some of the hospital people were interested in what I had to say too. So I came I've been here since Friday. I don't leave till Thursday. So it's been quite a trip here.
How did you get into yoga? I read that you became disabled at 13, but you didn't find yoga till 25. What happened in between?
All sorts of stuff. So I am 58 now, so I've been doing this a long time. I feel like a grizzled veteran at this point, practicing for 33 years. But I was injured in a car accident when I was 13. My father and sister were killed. My mother and brother weren't physically hurt. And I went through a shredder. I broke my neck and my back, both my wrists, filled the lung with fluid, and had an injury to my pancreas that left me unable to eat for 60 days. I was in a coma. So I woke out of, we were just traveling on we hit an icy patch on a day that was misting. So the unthinkable happened in my family, right? I woke up from that. And the medical model, they saved my life. I mean, I was so injured. Right, I was in the hospital for 6 months. Can you imagine what that would be now? Can't even imagine. No one would pay for that, right? But basically the rehabilitation vision that I encountered was to basically, I'm paralyzed from the injury that sustained and hurt my spinal cord was a T4, so about my chest. And basically I was guided to make my upper body really strong. Mm-hmm. And learn to drag my paralyzed body through life, which is kind of a cultural meme of disability. You're supposed to overcome it like it's an obstacle, but the truth is it's the only body you're ever gonna have, right? So, and I was a very athletic young boy, and I missed my body, and I did what I was supposed to do. I stopped listening to my lower body, learned to manage my life, but I missed my body, and I was in graduate school at the time, and studying philosophy and the mind-body problem, I didn't even know I was thinking about myself. And I just decided it was time for me to try to re-inhabit my body. And I thought, what better way to do that than a time-tested practice that's about integrating mind and body and whatever people want to call spirit. So once I started that and I started to be able to live in my whole body despite being able to feel it directly, I realized that this is really important, not just for me. So I practiced really diligently for 7 years, and then I started teaching people and trying to share the insights about that apply to disability, but I also teach traditional students, walking around students. And then I formed a nonprofit in 2002.
If it's okay, I want to ask you about that experience of grief. I mean, you woke up and your whole life had changed. How do you come to terms with that? And what was that experience of grief like?
Well, the one thing about the experience of disability is that it's ongoing. I sometimes joke and say it takes 10 years to realize you're disabled. And so it's a slower process. You wake up, and I'm also focused on losing my father and sister because they were also killed in the accident. Yeah. So I've got a whole bunch of grief, and yet I'm a young kid, and I've got my whole life in front of me, and it takes wisdom to know how to process grief. Mm. So I was more in the early days thinking about trying to get back to my life, trying to prove to everybody I could do my life despite being disabled. Right, and be involved in school and be involved in all the things, right? So early on, I would say I tried to plug back in, kind of like what you do, right? Yeah. The thing about grief is that it's an ongoing process, and even now I'm going through new levels of grief at 58. Mm. I'm aging with a spinal cord injury, and now I'm realizing some of the full implications and how hard it is now as my body also ages. So in terms of jumping back into my life, at first I wanted to prove that I was okay. And then part of coming to yoga was I started to really grieve at 25. I missed my body. Coming back alive after you've abandoned your body is full of grief because there's nothing more painful. It's a great line from Toni Morrison's Beloved, right? There's nothing more painful than coming alive from the dead. And in some ways, I left my body behind, like I could never be on the inside of my paralyzed body. And that's just not true. But coming back to life, a process that's beautiful and whatever, it has to have grief. One of the things that I think about grief is that it's a precondition of realization. It's a stunning human innovation, right? It's like the watering of dry soil. And I love that it actually dropped tears from your eyes, right? Like you're watering again to land in what's true and what's been lost and figuring out how to come back and move forward. So grieving, the one thing I would say from how much I've been through, and I've been through a lot, right? It's not just that injury, is that I'm not afraid of grieving. I now recognize that it's part of the process of becoming. And that doesn't mean I like it, but I'm not afraid of tears. I'm not afraid that I'm weepy. I'm really sensitive. It's okay, right? And I want the world to be a better place, all of those things. But I want to come at it from a sense of my own vulnerability, and grieving is vulnerable. We try to avoid grief, and we shouldn't. It's how we become. So yes, it was hard to plug back into my life. Right. And I still, like right now, you know, as you come towards retirement, like I'd love to travel all the time, but my body's worn out. You know, yeah. I'd like to see more of the world. And there's a whole bunch of experiences I'm not going to get. And that's always been true when you live with a disability. Right. You're always, you know, I'm not going to go to the upstairs of your house. Even if you invited me, if you have a really cool deck, I'm not going there. I accept certain things. There's still losses. Can't pretend they're not losses. Mm-hmm. This is not the body I wanted, right? But boy, I wouldn't trade it. I've had quite a life.
Talk to me about that. You wouldn't trade it. I mean, I can understand, but I think a lot of people, when you talk to them and say, like, I wouldn't trade my life as a disabled person, it kind of shocks them because they think disability is, like, the worst thing that can happen.
Right, and that's from their perspective. Obviously, I'd trade if my father and sister could be alive and have a full life. So there's clearly, you know, I'd go back and trade
Absolutely.
It. I remember the moment when I realized this. It was when, really deeply, there was a moment where I was, I've always helped, you know, talked about what it is to be disabled. And I was just first practicing yoga. And I was a couple years into it, and I was teaching to a bunch of first graders, seven-year-olds. There's nothing more beautifully innocent than young kids, because they just ask the most beautiful questions, and they're very direct, right? And I'm saying all these things about yoga and all I can still do, and then this little kid comes up to me and says, But don't you miss walking? And it was beautiful. And the answer is, yeah, I'd like to go on a hike. I'd like to do all that. And I said to him, and I could say it, and that only came after yoga, I wouldn't trade what I'm becoming. This is the only life I get to have. Mm. right? I can't imagine, I never would have been a yoga teacher. I can tell you that for sure. Yeah. I wouldn't become a philosopher of consciousness and writing a book on the limits of minds and the importance of body, right? I wouldn't do any of that, right? If I hadn't had the one life I get, right? So I don't want to try to overcome my life and prove anything to anybody. But that means I have to be okay with the losses too. And that's a process, and it's a change.
Tell me about that process. Like, how do you confront that grief and face it with that vulnerability and, you know, not be in strength and not be afraid of it?
Well, one of the things when you've gone through a lot, you live with your situation and you know that life has measured you. Mm-hmm. So I'm not someone that's, hey, bring on whatever, but I am someone that has a quiet confidence that life's measured me, it continues to measure me, and I know how to answer the bell. Like, so I have this deep confidence of inner knowing that I can get through things, right? Including my own grief. And it turns out that processing, that's how I think human consciousness processes loss and then starts to be able to see possibilities. Right, I realized that I missed my body at 25. I realized that it'd be good for my life if I made my body and trying to live fully in it part of my life's work. Right, and that I could help others. And that brings purpose to it too. Purpose is good.
Yeah.
You know, I like that. I like purpose. But the to not be afraid. One of the things I like to say to people is you got to learn. It's a really important thing to not be afraid of your own grief. And part of that process is to be able to distinguish between tears of annihilation and tears of cleansing. Mm. A lot of people are afraid of crying because they think they're going to disappear. They're going to get annihilated by the thing that's happening. And no, usually by the time you're able to grieve, you've already survived enough to be letting it go. And so cleansing tears are essential for growth. Right, and so people, their minds are afraid of feeling grief. They think they're gonna like disappear or get annihilated by it. Nah, your mind struggles, your body doesn't struggle. Your body will keep moving forward. Yeah. The body has to show the mind how to live at certain points in everyone's life.
Tell me about how your mind showed your body how to live. Like, how did you reconnect
my body showed my mind how to live.
Sorry.
Right? See, but that's how we think about it, right? And I'm part of what I'm here talking about at the University of Buffalo is what does body to mind resilience mean? So one of the things you gotta realize about your body is that it's already solved the problem of living. With every moment, no matter what your body's doing, it will go towards living with every ounce of energy it has. It has shown me that. I survived things that you cannot believe. I can't believe it. Like, my mind doesn't grasp it. At the time, my mind had to disassociate to deal with all the pain. Like, and I want people to know that even if they age, their body's not betraying them. Their body's doing the best it can. And the body's gonna stay faithful to living. It's the mind that struggles with living. So like, for example, the body already knows where the present is, right? The mind goes in and out of phase. The mind gets lost in memory. The mind worries about the future. The body's always in the present. So when I'm dealing with people, like when I'm helping people like Alzheimer's or with dementia, you gotta show them where their body is. Mm-hmm. For someone that's struggling with their life, their body is the one that's staying steady. It's the mind that's wavering all over the place. But there are also certain things, like for example, for anyone to truly be healthy, I don't think we talk about this enough. You need to be good at balancing between what you give and what you receive. That's a fundamental, like if I were to give one piece of advice about how to live a better life, get better at receiving too. And guess, have you noticed, are you really good at taking a compliment? Minds don't actually receive very well. They push things away.
Yeah.
Right? Bodies know how to receive. So like, I mean weird things. I mean like simple things. Like when you get in bed at night, let your body support you. Let the bed support you. Let your mind receive the support of the bed. Like, practice basic interactions of what it is to feel supported in your body, and let that transform your mind. Don't always be looking to solve all your problems with your mind. Your mind's the one that struggles. Mm. The body has a wisdom that our culture is missing. Like, really, and it has to do with the present, it has to do with grounding, it has to do with knowing what support is, what to receive is, what feels good. Someone that lives with a lot of chronic pain, there are some pains that are so systemic, they're touching everywhere in their body. But if my mind's relationship to my body is only mediated through pain, like let's say like rheumatoid arthritis, you have certain places in the body that hurt more. If my mind is stuck where it's always gonna hurt and not paying attention to the pleasant and better sensations in other places in the body, I'm gonna start really having a bad relationship with my body because everything's being mediated by pain. You need to facilitate the sensation of relief. Mm-hmm. Sensation of relief is possible to create in almost, maybe only in a glimpse, in anybody I've ever worked with. And I want a student or someone I'm trying to help to realize what it is from body to mind to distribute the sensation of relief.
And that connection is really powerful. I think as someone who lives with chronic pain, it's, you have to learn how to focus on different parts of your body, like you said, so that way you're not focused on that pain, because if you focused on that pain, you wouldn't be able to do anything.
Exactly.
Right? So how can anyone apply that connection and tap into that wisdom of their body to build that resilience, to be able to tap into that, to tap away from the pain?
Yeah, so, I mean, pain is a particular instance, as this applies to a lot of things. So, you know, there in the short term, if we're talking just about pain management, in the short term, sometimes disassociating or doing something that makes you be able to feel it less. But at a certain point, when you live with chronic pain, right, too much, a lot of it, you need to know where your boundary is. Because when pain really starts taking freedom, right, is when it becomes how you touch and interact with the world, right? That's always going through pain. So if you can know where the rest of your body is, so it, you can surround the place that hurts or the things that hurt, and you know yourself well enough to not just be where the mind's getting the strongest input from the part that hurts. You need to know that you surround the pain, that there's part of you that exists before and after what hurts. Right? While it's happening, if it's really acute, there are all different ways. But there are things to know that your body, your mind will go to what's the most dramatic. And pain's pretty dramatic. Yeah. It takes practice to not just hear the pain. And I'm not saying ignore your pain, because unfortunately, pain also comes to guide you. It's your body trying to get your mind's attention.
Yeah.
Right? So the relationship to pain needs to be much more sophisticated. It's an ally, strangely, until it isn't, and then it's debilitating. So this is one application of the ways that being more in your body is ultimately the better long-term strategy to managing pain. That's why, unless I really, really need it, I try not to take pain medication, because that is only dulling and affects the rest of my, I can't feel the sun as well.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that.
Can that apply to emotional pain too? Because we're coming up on the anniversary of the mass shooting in Buffalo. We just survived a blizzard last year. Mm-hmm. I think that this city has proved its resilience, but at the same time, I think we're still carrying a lot of like emotional pain and distress and the weight of those things that happened to us.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, I mean, this is also kind of a yogic precept, but it's also just a human truth. It's the mind that suffers more, right, than the body hurts and all that stuff. But when it comes to something like this anniversary and all the trauma, trauma's tricky. You don't get to heal it all at once, right? You do revisit. Anniversaries do matter, right? And going into all that happened, what I believe is that don't bury your face always in what hurts, right? Understand that it's there, and the reverberations of that day are gonna be in Buffalo's consciousness for a long time, right? And so when you feel yourself spiraling and going to the getting triggered into the trauma, that's a really good time to feel grounding, to wiggle your toes, to go, okay, you know what? That is in the past. I'm in the present. So our minds can time travel strangely more, and the body, you know, part of you is still there on that day, but the body's also in the present. And to reestablish the boundary between the past and the present is one of the keys to healing trauma, is that trauma has a way of collapsing the past with the present. And so if you can figure out some things to be, that day, let's say that day, do some nice things for your body too. Don't do it to ignore what happened. But as you start to process, take a walk, feel your shower, take a drink of water, like, exercise a little bit, honor the grief by doing something with your body too. Don't just get stuck in the time travel that the mind will go back to the trauma. Allow it to do that part of it, but let yourself be more on that day and use your body to help you do it.
Yeah, tell me more about your yoga practice, what makes it unique, and how you get people to center themselves and their bodies.
I think that we've underappreciated how robust our nervous system is. That we tend to think about our bodies in terms of what we can control and what we can feel. Well, it turns out most of your body's things that are happening are not conscious to the mind, right? They're not there, right? And so what I try to show students is that, like, for example, let me talk more concretely. Often I when I work with spinal cord injured people, they tell me they have no sensation below the point of injury. And I can tell you, after doing this since 1997, I've never been with someone with a spinal cord injury that within 20 minutes, I can show them that they feel things from their paralyzed body, right? What's happened is they're not feeling the same things they used to, right? And so you have to help them retrain their ear. They're not listening to all the input that's still coming through to the mind, right? Because they've discounted it as not what it used to be. Well, and once you start to realize that, no, your body hasn't completely left you. It's only changed its voice. You've got to start listening to a whisper, to different cues. It's trying desperately to give input to your mind, right? And so what I try to show people is that their body that's not doing what they want on one level is still doing a miraculous job on another level. And part of it needs to be more of a partnership of recognizing each other's new language, right? And so it turns out that yoga has a methodology in asana, in particular, in yoga poses, that help you feel parts of your nervous system that you weren't paying. The importance of your breath is obvious, but like, even I was talking to you about the fact that there's a lot more awareness that's possible that happens through bones and alignment that distributes senses of relief through your whole body. There are so many ways, other than in my case, functional spinal cord, for me to live in my whole body. And that's what I'm trying to show. And it turns out that yoga has a whole bunch of methodology built into it that I'm glad I'm not having to learn it all myself. I get to step in, and there, it doesn't just have to be yoga. It's whatever mind body practice you have. There's a good chance there's some really good wisdom in it. And pay attention. And you know what? What I like about it is that it's kind of an adventure. I get to live in. There's a whole world out here that I didn't know, or in my body that I didn't know, in my nervous system. And that's what I've been trying to share.
Absolutely. You know, I think in the disability community, we talk a lot about that mind-body relationship and embodiment. And I think one of the incredible things about reporting on disability is I learn a lot about the wisdom the disability community has to share and the wisdom we gain through being disabled. Tell me a little bit more about the wisdom in disability.
I think there's so much, but one of the things that Mind Body Solutions, the nonprofit I founded, is we're also trying to raise the voice of disability, not just as, you know, it should be a civil rights movement. We should, like, change the way things are happening in the structure of our society, for sure, but there's an incredible amount of wisdom that happens in the experience. So, like, think about if people were to get better at realizing they don't get everything they want. Let's just take that simple idea for a minute, just for a second, like pause. That it's not everything's going to go your way, and you have to learn how to not have that make you less. You have to learn how to lean into the fact that there are some things that are not going to happen, right? Like, there's profound wisdom in there. For example, when you live with disability and your life takes more time and everything takes longer, I used to say this all the time. Just think if someone could body the patience that someone with a disability has realized and then market it. This culture is so impatient. We get frustrated when we don't have 5G or now it's 10G. I have no idea, right? Like, you know, like we think, oh my God, something's happening that's not fair. It's like, oh my goodness. You know, time is supposed to be savored. It doesn't always have to be filled. Our culture is getting more and more, minds get more and more afraid of downtime, right? And so the wisdom there is there are all these deep things that, you know, what about, like, for example, I think my adaptive yoga students are often forced to be better yoga students than people that aren't disabled. It's because they have to learn how to integrate what they can't feel and can't control. And that's part of everyone's yoga practice, by the way. Mm-hmm. Everyone, you know, yoga in some ways is an integration of what you can feel and control with what you can't feel and can't control. Every yoga practice confronts that, no matter what body you live with. And my adaptive students have to confront that earlier, and because that, they end up being wiser. Yeah. So I want to, like, talk about, I had a friend of mine who also lives with a disability, his name is Kevin Kling, and he's a famous storyteller and author and playwright. He's amazing. And he told me once, he redefined the word disability for me, and I try to say it wherever I go. He said, disability, the prefix dis, doesn't mean un. Dante knew that disability meant having traveled to the world of shadow and reflection. So when you come, instead of thinking of disability as inability, it's ability that's traveled through the world of shadow and reflection. It's earned ability. Think about anyone's life. What have you actually truly gained as an ability that didn't have to be earned? If it comes too easy, it's not earned. Yeah. So to me, earned ability is wisdom. So disability is actually wisdom. And it's actually something that everyone should strive for. It's like, I mean, if it comes too easy, you don't really know what you've learned.
Yeah.
Right? So this idea that everything we ever realize has to travel through the world of shadow and reflection. And as you know, when you live with what you've had to live with too.
Yeah.
You don't take nearly as much for granted. You've earned what you're doing. And then you have things to say. No. So I'll follow Dante anywhere, right? If he says it's earned ability or ability that's traveled through the shadow and reflection, I'm in. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, that was something I've thought a lot about leading up to the interview today, is that becoming disabled at a young age, I watched my peers not grasp the things I was grasping at a young age. It's like you grasp, I think people think disability is fragility, but really you grasp the fragility of everything around you.
Correct.
And I don't know where I was going with this. I just, you know.
Well, yeah, no, but I do, yeah. Right? Like there's a you have to learn things earlier, but as you watch, like I'm 58 now, and I'm watching my friends age, and they can't believe they can't shovel the driveway. Yeah. And they're sore. It's like, no, that's what actually happens. Like, we have an insight into what it is, and we realize that our bodies are vulnerable, and that's not a weakness. That's an existential truth. I don't, you know, there's kind of a clever line where I say everyone's only temporarily abled, right? Yeah. And it's kind of to scare people, like, you know. But the truth is, everyone lives. It's an inevitable part of everyone's life path, unless you die suddenly. Everyone's going to become more disabled in their life. Mm-hmm. And it's not a bad word.
Yeah.
Especially, it's not a bad word, right? Especially when you change it to with, you know, older people, if they live well and they don't get bitter, they have a lot of wisdom that we need to learn from, right? And so it's something that we have to gain insight and appreciate the little things, right? I'm not going to get to go, you know, I'm not going to put out the effort to go climb Mount Everest in a wheelchair, right? But I'm certainly know how to more profoundly appreciate the lot that I live on. I know how to take in the beauty of what is, not always worrying about what's the next thing, right? And that's a thing that I would never have seen at the level and depth that I do.
Absolutely. And I'm wondering, you know, you do adaptive yoga. I think when people think of adaptive yoga, they think of like chair yoga or just kind of like these simplified versions of yoga. But what is adaptive yoga?
Oh, that's an easy question. Well, and some people would argue cleverly that all yoga is adaptive, right? Everyone's different. But there are core principles that make asana, yoga poses possible. And they're universal. So one of the things I like to say about yoga, as I'm teaching teachers especially, is that and students, right? But they're all the same, right? Is that the principles of yoga don't discriminate. Yoga poses do. Mm. Okay, so if you can understand more, and this is why I think my adaptive students ended up having to be better students, is that if you can understand how and why a pose is what it is at its core, closer to the hub of the wheel, instead of it being about being able to take your leg behind your head or do this crazy thing, by the way, that's not really yoga. Like, that's not where the core is. Learning to know and be able to move from the midline out through your body, being able to draw energy back to your midline, being able to elongate your spine, being able to realize what it is. So the like movements in ways, being able to move your limbs is kind of the window dressing. Remember, we're all a spine. The life force comes more through the spine. Organized by the brain, but the life force comes through the spine. And so, like, little shifts in gravity change. Like, I can feel, like, when I come forward on my sitting bones, after doing so much yoga, and this is what I can show people, is that you feel a change in your legs. That there's a whole, and that's because changes of gravity distribute awareness within the body. But it's not going to be how someone that can feel it. Like, if you tickle the bottoms of my feet, I don't feel it.
Yeah.
I don't feel it like you feel it, but something's happening. Yoga poses are like that. Hmm. Like, there are principles, like the sensation of being grounded. The problem when I see adaptive yoga students that live, let's say, with whatever disability, let's say a spinal cord injury again, and they want to do the outside of the poses because they want to look like everyone else. And they're violent with their body, or they throw themselves off balance. No good yoga pose happens when you're wildly off balance. Mm-hmm. Only violence happens, right? And so when you see someone that's like a wheelchair athlete, they tend to struggle with yoga because they want to, I can do it. I'm going to will my body. And that's not what yoga is about. It's trying to figure out how to balance what's inside with movement and expression to the outside. So it's not about what you're achieving from the outside. It's how well and how graceful you're being able to move. Like, for example, one of the things I try to pass on is that movement without a sense of direction leads to violence. Mm. So like in a transfer, when I'm transferring, right? If I just try to hoist my body with my strength in my upper arm, it's gonna end up wearing out my shoulders.
Yeah.
But no one ever taught me in rehabilitation that I should be pushing down through my sitting bones and my heels, even though I can't physically do it. But movement with the sense of direction is grace. Mm. So when I hit down through my feet, hit down with my sitting bones, lift my lower abdomen up, and do that as I hoist my arms over, my poses, my movement is way less violent. Right, so it's like if you have strength, but it has no, that's the better line. If strength has no sense of direction, it leads to violence. Mm. If you can put your strength, my arm strength, in service of going down to go up, which no one ever taught me to do because I thought I couldn't move my body, right?
Yeah.
If I combine the two, then my strength in my arms goes in service of a sense of direction, and it becomes graceful. So there are things like that you can show that we don't rehabilitate, because the people that are doing the rehabilitation don't know these subtle truths about the mind-body relationship. That's why I train healthcare professionals.
Well, I think that's interesting, because it kind of goes back to what you were saying about very early on in experiencing disability, yourself and a lot of other people believe they have to present or be as close to able-bodied as possible. And what you're kind of saying, it sounds like, is that it's about taking those truths that we can all experience and figuring out how do you present that or experience that.
And again, starting from the baseline of your own body and moving out, and like with yoga and with life, if you start from where you are, you're going to get life better and you're going to accept yourself better. I mean, I can't believe how many people that I've worked with over the years that have disabilities that really don't like their body. Mm-hmm. I don't love my body. This isn't exactly the body that I wanted. I don't feel great about it every moment. But holy cow, it's doing a great job, right? I've had a lot of trauma in this body. And it's like, yeah, everyone can have wish they had a perfect body, right? But I'm going to learn and live from the body I have. And if I do that, if I start from my home base, it's amazing what can be achieved. And achievement doesn't necessarily mean, oh, I can do all these different poses, which I used to do when I first started yoga. Achievement means all of a sudden, I know better how to be here. Mm. Like, and one of the big things for my yoga practice was strange. I do a lot of hands gestures, but I used to only talk with my upper body. You know, I used to think, and when there's this moment early on in my yoga practice where all of a sudden I realized, oh my gosh, I get to actually move and talk with my whole body, even though 2/3 of it is paralyzed, right? That actually everything still comes out of my whole body and not just the parts I control. That was profound healing. Mm. When I realized, oh my God, I still get to live in my whole body. I still get to have it. I don't just have to manage it. I get to live it. That seems so simple. It's transformative. And I want that for everybody, not just disabled people. Oh my gosh, we have such weird relationships to our bodies.
Well, tell me about that. What is it like teaching people who are starting from such different places? I mean, you teach people with disabilities, you teach healthcare professionals, yoga teachers, and non-disabled people. I mean, those are all coming from, I would think, wildly different perspectives.
They totally are, but what's great is that we all have a commonality, right? That like really, when you start to understand that it's not about the outside of the pose and it's not just whatever you do is fine, like you can move from inside to out. And the principles that make that possible apply to everybody. So what I say to when I'm training non-disabled yoga teachers to teach disabled people, right? I say, you're going to end up loving yoga even more because you're going to see that the principles of yoga apply to everybody. Mm. Like grounding, balance, the sensation of expansion. Holy cow, do we need that in our... Doesn't the world kind of make you feel small? Like the big problems are like, they seem impenetrable. Like how you're disempowered. Well, when you start to feel disempowered, you should take up space and not take up less space. You should learn that there's a sensation of expansion. When you live with a disability and sit in a wheelchair, you think you don't take up space in the world? No, you can still take up space, and not just because you yell. You need to like live to the outer edges of your body. You have to live into space and lean into space. You learn this in yoga poses. Like that, there's a universal principle in almost every yoga pose that a lifted chest is in every pose. Do you know why you lift your chest in a yoga pose? It's because it distributes energy through the limbs. Like the world will be heavier if you drop your chest. Yeah. You know, really bad posture. Posture is not a moral issue. It's an energetic expansion. If you do it too rigid, then that's not so good. But the lifted chest. This is the most integrated part of human, in my opinion, of human consciousness. And when you open your chest, when you stay connected, and that kind of makes you want to smile, right? You can see you smiling back at me when you're hearing it, right? It's like literally it makes you enter the world, right? You don't see really depressed people. You see depressed people hunkered over and down and suffering people. Yeah. There are certain things about how we live our spine that we need to do more, and it's going to help our mind. That's what I mean about body to mind learning. It's like, oh my goodness, I don't have to be in charge of everything with my head. That in fact, some of what happens here, I should lead more with the center of my chest and not just my emotional chest. Like literally keep your chest lifted. Not all the time. I like slouching. I'm a sloucher too, right? But I want to live in the body I have.
Well, I smile because it's like, I feel like that idea of like sitting up in a very specific way, like having quote unquote good posture. It's like you're almost trying too hard when good posture is truly where you're comfortable. And I think that's a lesson you learn when you're disabled too, is like living in your body well isn't necessarily about presenting in the way people expect, but presenting in the way that gives you comfort and ability to be confident.
Yeah, like with posture, let's talk posture for a second. We kind of taught as little kids, it's kind of a moral issue. It's how you're supposed to do it, like you're good for, you know. But in fact, it's just more energetically efficient. You don't see like a pillar. You don't see a bent pillar, right? Mm-hmm. They break, right? You don't just hold good posture to look good. You realize that if I sit up straight, at least for part of the day, it actually, the gravity flows through me better. I don't have to wear it. If I'm crooked, so I have scoliosis, so I'm crooked, right?
Yeah.
Right, that the gravity, the weight of gravity is gonna be hitting certain part of my vertebrae harder than others. When I straighten out, even if I can't do it all the time, if I straighten out and I hit down through my side, right now I'm straightening my spine, you know, if you're at the ear with me. And if I hit down with my sitting bones and down through my feet and I straighten my head and I take a couple of breaths, I feel better. Like, why wouldn't I want to do that? If I try to hold that, like I have to be that way all the time, that's going to be awful. So you want all the spaces. You want good posture. You want bad posture. You want the whole thing. Because why wouldn't you want to live in more spaces, right? Like, not just have to do it through bungee cord jumping. Like, people, like, want risk and adventure. It's like, why don't you actually try living in the spaces that are in your body? And you're going to be amazed at how that's going to transform how you live your life.
Yeah. And that's an adventure in itself. And speaking of adventure, and you don't just travel and do this work, but you also exist online, so anyone can access this.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about why that's important, because I've noticed especially that I think there are, just anecdotally, I don't see a lot of adaptive classes. If I do, they're kind of
like lame. They're kind of lame.
I shouldn't say that. No, that's fine. But I mean, like, it is like that idea of like, okay, it's adaptive in the sense like you can do it from a chair. It's not adaptive in the sense like it's disabled people and non-disabled people coming together on that common principle that you talk about. So tell me about why it's important that you make this accessible in the way that you are.
So first of all, I challenge you to come. We teach all our classes in chairs online. I promise if you come to my class, you're going to work harder than you want to, right? Because it can be really challenging. They can also be like gentle yoga, and there are other classes like that, right? So they're challenging even for, quote, more traditional bodied people to take my adaptive classes that I teach online in a chair. They're going to get more than they bargained for, and not just because they're physically hard. They're inwardly challenging. And outwardly challenging, right? So there's a lot of ways. But like, we went exclusively online during COVID. And what we found being online, so we don't teach in person anymore at Mind Body Solutions. We found a couple things that we were able to offer all the classes for free at no cost.
Wow.
So they're no cost classes. And that's really important for people that live with disability who are on fixed income. So that's why we have to have Kiss My Asana. We have to have fundraisers. We have to raise money. The other thing that happened online is now we have a global community, right? The one thing that Mind Body Solutions and our adaptive yoga community online tries to do is something that I don't think is out there in the world, I think at all, is supporting the experience of trauma, loss, and disability from body to mind, which you get to come with. There are, in most of our adaptive classes, we welcome everyone, but there are a lot of people with the disabilities. We know the inside of disability. We know how to support each other. So, like, we're trying to build and expand a community that we actually want to go to? Have you ever been to those support groups that kind of like, ugh, right?
Many of them are focused on like, I'm so frustrated with my situation.
Right.
And it's very different to be in a space that's much more focused on like, how do I live through this situation?
That's what we're doing. And then you get people that are supporting each other in the process. So that's what the Adaptive Yoga Community is doing online. And we're reaching people from all over the world. So that's another advantage of being online, right? Is that our community is expanding. There's more, especially geographical diversity in it. And, you know, again, the bigness of a movement does not determine how much yoga is happening, right? So it doesn't have to be like going up upside down on your head. But for example, I know how to teach inversions without going upside down. I mean, there are all these things that Mind-Body Solutions and I've innovated about how to teach yoga that's going to make you at the end of it go, oh, wow, I feel my whole body humming, even though I never stood up from this chair. And that I want that for everybody. I mean, at one point I used to have a program called Bringing Your Body to Work. I would train this, I'd teach people how to stay more active in their body while they're working, because your mind needs your body to be clear. You mean, you know, creative people will go take a walk, or you get stuck in a problem and you get up and walk around, or you get up and move around. It's because the mind needs the body. It needs to reboot through the body so the mind can get creative again. We need our bodies. We need to take breaks.
Well, and you know, something that just came to mind, and I didn't mean to say chair classes, like, but I mean that.
I want to retract and call them lame. Sometimes I feel like they're patronizing. They're too gentle voiced and not demanding enough. Well, no, there's ways to teach. There's a lot of ways. And sometimes those classes are great.
Yeah, well, what I was trying to get at, I think, is that, for example, one time I went to a class that was aimed at older adults because I was hoping it would be more adaptive to my physical needs. And I showed up, and when I was doing the movements wrong, they actually stopped the class and told me that I was bad at the exercises we were doing and kicked me out of the class.
Oh no, that's just awful.
It is.
I'm offended on multiple levels at this point.
But I think it's like that focus, right, of like, so many of these classes are focused on doing the movements right and not that inner component that you're talking about. But I'm wondering, like, how do you handle those situations where if the focus of the fitness class or the wellness class is on that inner component and you have people coming in who do have that self-hatred or that negativity towards their situation, how do you meet people where they're at, and how can we meet people where they're at in connecting their body to their mind?
Well, first of all, I just want to smile and go, hey, come check it out, Emily, right? You'll see exactly how we do it, right? Any listener, right? There are ways, again, if you realize that there are, when I say there's universal principles in yoga poses that make all yoga poses possible, one of the things is that, so like one of the ways how you can teach yoga universally is teaching at the core of the pose. And then let's say you had someone that's had a stroke and they can't take their arms wide. And so, but I'm teaching in a pose where I'm having people take their arms wide, right? Mm-hmm. And they can't do it. But I'll be giving instructions. I won't not have people take their arms wide, but I'll give instructions and, hey, if you can't take up your arm, extend from the center of your chest out to the tip of your shoulder. And while you're doing that, hit down through your sitting bones. So I will have given the instructions that were more to the core of the body. So I said, and if you can't take it out, that's just window dressing anyway. Here's what you should work on. But that's good for anybody's pose, whether they can take their arms wide or not. So you give the core of the pose that's more accessible to everybody. And then you keep layering on instructions and de-emphasize the importance to be able to do them all, but to maintain integrity in the movement you're making. So some people can't twist very much, or some people can't do stuff. And so, but if you can do a little tiny twist, right, and then realize that that's as powerful as a big twist. In fact, I would say more powerful if you like have the patience to like move your spine a little bit and receive what happens. Not about how far you twist, it's about how well you twist. So you start teaching things from the inside out, the sensations in the poses, not the actions of the poses. And then suddenly everyone's getting a workout that they didn't expect. And they feel, they go, oh my, how was that so hard? I hardly moved. Well, no, you did. You moved at your core. Moving at your core is way harder than moving out at your outer edges.
I do want to ask, you're training healthcare workers this week. And
yoga teachers.
And yoga teachers, mm-hmm. but I'm kind of interested in the healthcare workers. I think that, you know, in the disability world, we talk about the medical versus the social model, the idea mm-hmm. that disability comes from a condition versus disability comes from society. And I think a lot of medical practitioners look at disability as something to be rehabilitated, and you talk about coming from that experience of someone trying to rehabilitate you and it didn't fully give you everything that you needed. How do you approach training healthcare workers, and what do you hope they take away from your trainings and talks?
Well, first of all, okay, so there's multi-layers to that. Yeah. I have a kind of multi-layered strategy about it. What I want is, like, what I'm trying to get across here in when I'm in University of Buffalo to healthcare workers is that the place of innovation that is low-hanging fruit is to improve the quality of the dynamic between patient and caregiver. Because if, you know, what happens, if I can, as a patient, be more engaged in my healing process, my outcome's gonna improve. So the dynamic, and I know that in health, these are big philosophical things, but I'm trying to make them practical. I know that if someone leaves the hospital system that's been a patient and they leave more connected to their body rather than less, they're gonna have a better life. Mm. So I specialize in helping integrate in practical ways mind-body principles into rehabilitation, but also into interactions between caregiver and patient. Right now, the best way to do that is to teach the mind-body principles to the caregivers to experience for themselves, because then it becomes kind of in the dynamic, right? And it turns out that caregivers themselves are burning out and having compassion fatigue. Mm-hmm. They need the mind-body principles to be able to be integrated into their own lives so they can be better caregivers, which will then trickle down into better patient care. So I'm trying to get them to realize the importance of utilizing their body while they're working to manage stress and fatigue, right? So I'm teaching them about the, and that they should take, quote, care of themselves, mm-hmm. right? Because I need them to do that as a patient, right? So I'm coming from the back door with them, saying that you need, because you gotta give people what they need. Right, and I know that the healing relationship is shared. No one really heals in a vacuum by themselves, right? And so if we could get, as patients even, invested in the well-being of our caregivers too, mm-hmm. so there's more of an exchange. Healing is a process that's done by a community, not just by an individual with a miraculous cure. And so I'm trying to help the quality of life of caregivers because I know that that's gonna help them with patients, right, eventually.
I know that you share your work not just through Mind Body Solutions, but you're a published author and you're working on another book. Tell me a little bit about that and what you hope to share with people through
the
your
first
writing.
Book or the second book?
Both. I'd love to hear about both.
Well, Waking, A Memoir of Trauma and Transcendence, the book that got all this started. No one really listened to me as a wild out there crazy yogi until I wrote a book. And I wrote a memoir that was about the journey, but it about my particular life, but it's not about disability directly. It's about trauma, and it's trying to be written in a way that people can see their own traumas in my story. Mm-hmm. It's very much trying to not be an overcoming of disability, but kind of like we talked about, learning from the only life you have, right? And so the goal of Waking was to help someone recognize themselves in the process of my learning to re-embody after trauma and the tendency to disembody when you're going through hardship. That's one of the human default ways we survive at first, is to disembody. So since I wrote Waking, and I founded Mind Body Solutions in 2002, Waking came out in 2006, and I started training healthcare professionals after that. I started to be able to get people to listen to what I was talking about and train yoga teachers, and I also have a lot of insights that I like to share about trauma and how we process trauma, because I'm a trauma survivor, right? Yeah. Gone through a lot. now with the next, I wrote a second book that sits fatally flawed on my computer. It went out to market, and it was thought to be, I found this frustrating, I thought this to be, they thought that it was an adaptive yoga book only, when it's an attempt for me to write on human consciousness. And it's about, was trying to be about the sources of compassion and nonviolence, coming out of a process of embodiment. And it was a little bit caught between being essays and memoir. This book is, remember, I'm a recovering philosopher too. I don't know, we haven't talked about that, but yeah, it's an attempt to say some things about yoga, say some things about trauma, write it beautifully. I believe in beautiful writing, right? Yeah. I don't want to get people worn out with too much philosophical stuff, but it is trying to talk about the limits of mind and the importance of body in the manifestation of human consciousness, and that we've kind of got so caught up in our minds that we're losing how to be connected to the earth. Like, for example, we're losing, remember, the earth is the biggest body you and I will ever directly know, right? So mind-body integration, realization of, this is an environmental book, but it's definitely, earth is one of a character in the background of the biggest body we'll ever be connected to. And so one of the things I think that minds tend to do is become disconnected from their surroundings. It's part of its superpower. Minds are the organs of disconnection. Spines are the organs of connection. And we need to come back. Our minds need our body as we're processing the immense complexity of our current time. We need to stay grounded. And Earth is beautiful, right?
Yeah.
And we're missing so much by getting so caught up. So the book is about human consciousness figuring out how to be more connected to the surroundings, even to the empty space that surrounds us.
Yeah.
It's flowing through us. The empty space is both inside and outside of us. And we're missing something. So it's a book about that. It's called, the working title, I think it might make it, the working title is called A Scout Wolf and a Hula Hoop.
Interesting.
Meditations of a Broken Yogi. So I'm reflecting on a whole bunch of stuff.
One last question. What do you hope people take away from your work, the talks you did in Buffalo this week, and this conversation?
I really try not to say barfy things. Okay, but this is what I try to get to everyone. No matter what your life is, no matter what you're struggling with, and all the pain and suffering you have in it, all the complexity of it, I want people to remember and get reconnected to, life actually feels good at the very core. I want people to wonder about their mind-body relationship. I want them to realize that their body, with wonder, not like I gotta go learn something, but my goodness, my body is showing me things that my mind so desperately needs. Like, the best way to teach, in my opinion, to help a mind start trusting the world again, is to show the body what it feels to be supported, so the mind doesn't have to be hypervigilant. There's so much wonder that we've missed by not paying more attention to our bodies. Not just being mindful of bodies, but let sensations permeate, grounded sensations permeate our minds. And I want people to feel the little boy wonder I feel of, oh my goodness, it opens so many possibilities.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Matt. I really appreciate you chatting with me today.
It's been an honor.
This has been What's Next. For the Disabilities Beat, I'm Emily Watkins.